Hare Krishna. Okay, so we'll start with your realization for the week. We have a couple microphones there. Realization, what is a realization? Where do they come from? I mean, I guess we have an objective in life. We're moving in a certain direction. What direction are we moving? Well, I mean, if you really analyze it, most people are looking for happiness. Otherwise, why are they moving? Not certainly to find distress. There's a sense that wherever I'm going, I'm going to get something when I get there, isn't it? And if it's not something good, then I'll have a tendency to stop going there or not want to go there. Or one time I was walking in San Francisco with Satyadev Prabhu. It was during a Sankirtan outing we had downtown Market and Powell. And I was saying how I saw all the shoppers out and I said, everyone's looking for happiness. And he commented that actually, in his experience, most people were trying to avoid distress. It's more the case. People are trying to avoid distress. But either way, everyone's motivated to move. Otherwise, why move? In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna had asked Krishna about the call over the symptoms of an enlightened person, somebody whose consciousness is in transcendence. How does he sit? How does he walk? And I mean, what does that mean? How does he walk? I mean, why does he walk? How and why does a person walk? I mean, why does anybody go anywhere? Before I joined the Krishna Consciousness Movement, I remember having this very powerful realization that nobody was going anywhere. I'd look out and I'd see people driving around, and I'd think, where could you go? There's nowhere to go, really, because wherever you go, as they say nowadays, there you are. And sometimes after school, I'd sit up on the hill and I'd watch all the students leaving, and everyone was running in a certain direction, and I was thinking that there's nowhere really to go. Don't you realize we're kind of floating in space in the middle of a universe somewhere? And what about that? There's not a lot of thought about it. There's mostly thought about how to fulfill my immediate needs. But those are based on either alleviating distress or finding some kind of happiness, right? So in the course of life, unless we have some specific idea of where we're going, then the general idea, the default mode, is that I'm trying to avoid distress, or I'm trying to find some kind of happiness, and what's the next immediate kind of happiness that I'm looking for. But for those who have a very specific goal, which is related to finding happiness through what we may call transcendence or through spirituality, then there are guides for that. There are things that have been written and left behind, which if one reads, begin to make a lot of sense. They speak to us, actually. They're not just random. There's an intrinsic value to them in that when we read them, we can see that they echo what's also being spoken from within. We hear a lot about knowledge that comes from within, and it does. Even great scientists speak about how oftentimes their greatest realizations in science come to them automatically. Well, not exactly automatically. As Louis Pasteur said, the greatest discoveries come unto only the prepared mind. But one who's in a discipline, in other words, they're looking for something specific, then as they're endeavoring for that, in the process, suddenly springing forth from within comes the formula or the idea of which way to go in discovering the object. So there's a sense that there's knowledge that comes from within. And the knowledge that we get externally, for instance, from the Shastra or from the scripture, from things left behind by self-realized persons, or as we say, from avatars, from the Lord himself who comes down to our level and then presents it in such a way that it's actually meant for us. And those two things should resonate. The feelings and the ideas that I'm getting from within, and the knowledge that's coming from the written things and from the previous teachers, they should validate what I'm feeling inwardly. And then there are also other practitioners, those who practice and have been practicing for a long time, who've experienced things that validate their process. And because step by step they're finding that these things are being validated, they also get great strength and faith in the process unswerving faith because they see clearly where they're going and how they're getting there. And they're also a source of stability for us in devotional service. And my ultimate point here, because we're talking about realization, is that if you have an object, which means to become situated above the mind, above the default of the material world, which is survival, birth, death, old age, and disease, and you're endeavoring based on standard books like Bhagavad Gita and through instruction that are coming from those who are already practicing and from your own inner voice, which is validated by these other things, then there's very likely to be revelation, one's own revelation, when all those things harmonize and I see it for myself and I say, oh yes, this is how it is. It's something that's undeniable. That's what I'm defining. All this I'm just saying to define what I'm saying is a realization. That's what a realization is. When all those things come together and you experience it as something that has been a gift from within, from without, and both and all those things work together. So, you know, just in a general sense, that's what I'm just saying that's a realization. And it's important to hear from others. So, what are your realizations from your journey, from your practice in Krishna consciousness? You want to start, Dave Rue?
Well, I've been I guess the way I define a realization is a recognition of truth and experientially. Maybe we read about truth in the Bhagavad Gita and then we recognize that truth experientially. And I've been noticing or becoming more aware of presence. You know, what is presence? Because last week I read a verse in a purport that really inspired me in the 13th chapter. And Prabhupada, that chapter is about, it's about knowledge, it's about the knower, and it's about the field. Krishna says that one who understands that they're the knower, and that this body is the field, that's knowledge. And then Prabhupada, in one verse, in one purport, Prabhupada says that when one understands they're the knower, then they can actually enjoy the nectar of life. That person can really become happy even in this world. And so I've been noticing presence. When I'm present, then I'm actually the witness of what's going on. You know, I'm aware of my feelings and my thoughts. Do you ever like drive down the road, like maybe to the temple, and you were so much absorbed in thinking that you didn't even notice driving here? It just suddenly you end up here at the temple and you think, wow, how did I get here almost? Because so lost in the mind, so lost in thinking about usually what is not present. And thinking about the future, thinking about the past, and just totally absorbed in thought like that. And I notice when I'm like that, I'm not practically alive. I don't notice my life. And it's in life that the real nectar is. There's a joy to being alive and to be feeling your connection with Krishna that gets obscured by the mind. And so I was just noticing, or I guess you could say realizing, that my happiness is really the ability to be happy or unhappy is it's there in the palm of my hand. If I allow my attention to become lost in just thinking, then there's so much anxiety is there. You know, all your self-doubt, all your anxieties about the future, all your lamentation about the past, that's what will be the experience. But if you're present, and then you notice your presence, and then you notice that Krishna is the source of that, there's joy in that, real joy. But you can't have that if you're not present. So that was my recognition of truth recently. Next.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, this morning I was up early for one of the few times that I'm up early. And I just was meditating, chanting, and I looked out the window, and then everybody was popping out of their garages, and they're all flying down their driveways, and I could just feel it was the first time where I really felt the modes where I've developed a little taste now of higher feelings of spiritual happiness, so I could see that they were all running out for sense gratification, all of them, and to me that looked miserable. And then I felt compassion. I thought they're going to be suffering because they don't know about God consciousness. So that was my realization this morning. I've never saw it that way before, that they were all going out for sense gratification and then just totally oblivious of Krishna.
Nice. Thank you very much. Good eye?
I had a very profound experience this week, actually. Yesterday, you know, as part of that cookie prasad distribution, so met with a person which Prabhuji has met earlier. And I could not sleep yesterday, you know, pretty late. It was very spooky. and... I was just amazed at how modes of the three modes work together. So there is a drive, and how all the jivas are interacting to have that larger truth, getting a direction. So I met with a soul who is very pure at heart, looks like, and I believe he is, and he doesn't have too much of information about Krishna consciousness, and he has been like for 15-20 years on Bible and all. He teaches people Hebrew. He has stayed for 15 years in Israel and done a lot of studies. He is very good. He tries to do a lot of good things. So internally, I see how, there are, these three modes. Like, he is in a mode of goodness, then Mataji prepared cookies, and then Prabhuji has set up that there should be a monthly follow-up program, and then, the cookie reaches, and he's reading something, and he's able to relate. He is thinking of something of why to offer food in a book, and he's reading some things. In which a monk is staring at him and not talking with him. And so the revelations, what he was saying and how it was getting together, it was, I was somehow very, very perplexed as how Gauranga Mahaprabhu has its, how Bhaktivinoda Thakur has made these arrangements that people in America are going to get all this divine nectar. So it was a profound experience.
Thank you. Charlene, is that your Bhagavad Gita you brought with you? That's nice. Tell us where you got it. Can you use the mic? Because don't mind, but they're listening in the back.
I think it was a couple years ago, or maybe I think a couple years ago. So I went to Walmart and somebody came up and gave this to me. And
then how nice.
I had it for a while and then I picked it up a couple months ago, and so I decided to try and come here to see if you know what it was about.
That's nice. Did you read some of it already?
Yeah, I have.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Nice. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Very nice.
I have a realization from school. It's like everyone there, they're all like, oh, I want this, I want that, and all that. They're just wasting their time on sense gratification. They don't care about anything. They don't only care about, I want this, I want that, I don't want this, I don't want that. They just care about that. And every day, I just look at them and they're all like fooling around, doing nothing, not paying attention at class. Not even anything. They're not even doing anything which is good enough for their ordinary life. So then they can go and get pick up a Bhagavad Gita soon. But but then today there was like a substitute teacher today who was like really nice for the first couple of minutes. But then she got somehow switched with another one, which is so mean. But the first 5 minutes, it was so no good. But they didn't take those 5 minutes as very gradually. They didn't take it, you know, well. They just, she's going to be here all the time. They didn't. So then they wasted their time fooling around while she was there. And then she was switched with another one. And she was really mean.
I get the impression that you don't like to waste time.
So, I would spend every minute there. The nice one was there, nicely. So then, I took my time very well with them. Not really well. They just fool around. That's all I should say.
Thank you very much, Kadai. Yeah, and a day in the life. Your realization for the day? For the day or the week?
I think when you really desire something, Krishna makes it possible, and I realize that today. Like all this week, I've kind of been, I don't know why, but I was dreading Ekadashi. I don't know why. And I thought it would be very hard. And last night I was really, just praying to Krishna to allow it to be pleasant. And it's been one of the best, most fulfilling and rich Ekadashis I've ever had. And it just started out that way and it's gotten better. And so it's I guess not a big surprise, but it's very nice to see these kind of things happen in life, and it's a great realization for me that, you know, when we really need something and we ask for it, Krishna provides it.
Wow, that was nice. Thank you very much. Thank you for the text message this morning, too, about Happy Ekadashi. Happy Ekadashi to you, too. Charlene, right? Ekadashi, he was mentioning. It's a special day. We have, it's kind of an astrological day. It happens every twice a month, on the 11th day of the waning and the waxing moon. There's influences kind of in the universe according to the heavenly bodies, like the moon makes the tides ebb and flow and things like that. And they have effects on us also. And then, so it's called Ekadashi, which means the 11th day. And we on those special days, today is one of those, we do a little more concentration on our spiritual practice on those days. And it's we kind of mark that on the calendar as like a special time. Kind of like when they have a sale at Macy's or something, you know, you get extra that day. So we do a little extra on those days. That's what he was talking about. This is Charlene. Everyone should introduce themselves who hasn't met.
Praja.
My name is Jonathan.
Did you meet Gadai? You met Gadai, okay. Okay. All right. Whoops, you gave your microphone away. Your realization for the day or week.
Well, realization for a week was not a very long time into the week now. I mean, I should wait till Sunday. But so far, I was thinking that in many ways when we try to serve Krishna and we sincerely want to serve Krishna, but somehow or other you stop doing one service, Krishna immediately engages in something else. Mm. And it's something that's very encouraging because you know that Krishna is actually paying attention to you and paying attention to your progress and kind of takes care of you in that way. And of the day, time goes by and there's nothing you can do about it. It doesn't stop and ever. It just keeps going. So if you are anticipating for something to happen, I kind of had a realization today that it will happen anyway. It's coming. So no matter how much we would like for it to come faster or slower, it's going to come on its own accord.
Thank you. I had a realization. It's something it's a reoccurring realization because when I travel, which I'm doing tomorrow, I'm going to Toronto for 4 days, 5 days. And I get a lot more done like the day before I'm leaving. And I just notice my consciousness becomes more intense. It sort of happens automatically right before I'm leaving because I realize all the things I should have done before and the things I won't be able to do for 5 days. So I try to compress them all into one day. And so then I always think of travel also as practice for leaving, stepping out of the body. Because, you know, when you travel, you sort of have to leave behind your comfort zone and everything. And you have to decide what you're going to take with you also. You can't take everything, although I usually try. But, you know, leaving the body is also, it's a profound experience because I'm leaving everything behind, except for my attachments and my feelings and things like that. So it's just kind of the realization was that, first of all, the travel's healthy every once in a while to go out to see the Lord's creation from a different angle. It's refreshing. Traveling Sankirtan's nice. And, you know, going out for the purpose and that, it helps prepare our minds and sort of stir things up in a way so we can see things from a different angle. So tonight, we'd like to start with reading some translations from the Bhagavad Gita. Charlene brought her Bhagavad Gita that she got at Walmart a couple years ago. And are there any chapters that you've read so far that you favor or... Do you care where we start, or do you have any questions or anything like that? Okay. So anywhere we read, it's fine with you, right? Okay. So I'm going to pick a few sections so we can read through us. Let's take some samples. How about this? We'll take some samples of the Bhagavad Gita so you can kind of get acquainted with a few different sections. Does that sound okay? So one of the first parts I'd like to look at is in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And starting on page number 80, Charlene, does yours have at the top of the page, I just want to make sure it's the same as our book because slightly different version. It should say 212 on the right-hand side. Is that the right one? Actually, for now, do you mind using the same version we're using? Om Jnanatimirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militandina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Okay, we're on text number 11, and I'm just going to read a few texts to get a sense for this particular section of the Bhagavad Gita. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "While speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor for the dead." Text number 12. "Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be." Text 13. "As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change." Text 14. "O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O scion of Bharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed." Text 15. "O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress is certainly, and is steady in both, is certainly eligible for liberation." I'm going to read that over. "O best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation." Text 16. "Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both." And text 17, "That which pervades the entire body you should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul." Now I'm going to read the translation, the purport to text number 17 at the bottom of page 87. "This verse more clearly explains the real nature of the soul, which is spread all over the body. Anyone can understand what is spread all over the body. It is consciousness. Everyone is conscious of the pains and pleasures of the body, in part or as a whole. This spreading of consciousness is limited within one's own body." So let's just stop for a second here and discuss this, of the spreading of consciousness throughout the body. So what does that mean, that the consciousness is spread throughout the body? Does anybody have any practical experience? Like right now, you can just, this is experiential. Your consciousness is spread throughout your body. Let's think about it. Yes.
Well, as I understand, consciousness is being aware of something.
Mm-hmm.
And being aware of what's happening in your body because it's so big. We always feel when we, let's say, turn on hot water and we put our hands under it, we are conscious of the temperature, because then, even though it's not everywhere, but only in that particular part of the body, which is your hands, you're conscious of the, you know, contact with it. So your consciousness is making you understand what's happening in every part of your body to keep track of it being well and running.
That's a nice example. This is something I've had a realization about consciousness, how it's in the hand. So if I'm driving my car and my bag is in the back seat or even next to me, and I have to watch traffic, but I need to get something out of my bag at the same time. So I'll be driving along without looking, and I'll reach into the bag and feel around for the thing. And somehow, you know, my hand can recognize it. Like if it's, say if I'm looking for a bead bag, if I reach in there, I can feel the difference between a bead bag and a sandwich or whatever is in there. It just knows automatically, and it always makes me think about that, how the hand is really conscious. There's consciousness throughout my body, and it gets expressed through the feeling in my hand, which can interpret. Like if I reach in right now, I'm reaching in my bag, and I'm not looking, right? But I'm conscious that I'm holding on to a hat. You want me to prove it? Pulled a hat out of my bag. And I knew it was a hat before I even saw it. You don't need your eyes to be conscious. What else do I have in here? Now I know I have a bead bag in here. Because my hand can feel it. It's conscious. And there's proof. I just pulled it out with my hand. Because so consciousness comes through the finger. You can feel hot, cold. You can also distinguish an object just with your hand. It's conscious. What else about consciousness pervading your body? Any other experience of it? Stub your toe, yes.
Set you. I just want to make a comment about it.
That is experiencing consciousness in the body. It's such a normal thing that we just don't notice it and take it for granted. But it's extremely profound because we're thinking we're conscious of the body, that's... somehow bodily consciousness. It is bodily consciousness, but it's consciousness of the body. It's consciousness. It is the Atma. And at that point, there's no mind involved. It's direct perception of the Atma through the body. And it's an easy way to stay in the transcendental position, actually. It's just by noticing the awareness of consciousness pervading the body.
So take us through a quick exercise.
We can practice noticing, putting our attention on our hand and feeling our hand. Can everyone do that right now?
Do I have to close my eyes?
The thing is, like I was talking before, when I was driving down here one day, I was so absorbed in thought that I wasn't even aware of driving. So if we're particularly absorbed in some sort of thought, maybe what happened at the office or what's wrong with the kids or, what if I lose my job, we're not noticing the awareness in the body. So for a lot of people, you have to calm down a little bit. So right now, so Deepak, you can feel the consciousness in your hand. Yeah. And Charlene, can you feel the consciousness in your feet right now? Can you put your attention on your feet and feel your toes? Or you're more conscious of everyone looking at you? Can you feel the consciousness on the top of your head? Yeah? As soon as you put your attention there, the sensations there are automatically, right? Yeah. And can you just close your eyes and feel awareness through your whole body? Yeah. So that is direct consciousness. That is directly the Atma. If you start thinking about what you're experiencing, then you've entered into the mind. But the immediate perception is just directly consciousness being aware of the body. That's all. And it's transcendental. It's not the body. It's the consciousness. And it pervades the whole body.
Speaking about trance... I recently read a book about writing because I was in a writing retreat, and one day I needed a break, so I walked to the library and I pulled out a few books about writing just to keep my head in the game. And one of the books that I wrote was by a he was a psychologist, and he was also a writer. But in the book, he was talking about awareness, and he said in psychology he learned hypnotism at one point in his practice, how to hypnotize people, and then he realized that actually most people spend a lot of their day hypnotized. And what Satyadeva Prabhu was saying about driving someplace and not even realizing that you're driving, because you're used to driving, and your consciousness is somewhere else. You're not thinking about, you know, turning left, turning right. You just drive there, you know. You're in trance. And some people get in trance like watching the television. It's just, the brain is really shut off, you know. And if you say, hey, you know, they're like, yeah. And or there are a lot of different kinds of trances that the brain goes into. And, you know, the Yoga Sutras, there are descriptions of various kinds of consciousness. The conscious, you know, Yoga Sutras, Patanjali has categorized the different states that the consciousness goes into. Generally, we describe how there's a waking state, so-called waking state, and then there's a dreaming state, and then there's a deep sleep state. Deep sleep means susupti. It means there's no dreams. We exist, but we're not dreaming. And we come out dream state. Our so-called awake state that we're in now is another kind of dreaming state for the soul, actually, when he's unaware of his self, you know, that he's beyond the body. So we go into trance in many different ways throughout the day. Krishna's telling us here, and Satyadeva Prabhu just took us through this this exercise about how the consciousness pervades the body. And Prabhu was saying that just by being aware of consciousness, by being aware of the fact that I am conscious, and conscious pervading the body, it's a source of happiness. We were talking about this before. There's a satisfaction in knowing that you just exist. Someone asked me a long time ago, they said, are you a human being or are you a human doing? Can you just be, or do you have to do all the time? There's a sense I'm always doing something, but there's, you know, I am conscious, I can be conscious. So being aware, this is, someone once said that before you become Krishna conscious, you must become conscious. So this is part of being conscious, realizing what consciousness is and where it exists. So this verse where we're reading it from is page 88 in the Bhagavad Gita. At the top of the page, Prabhupada says, everyone is conscious of the pains and pleasures of the body in part or as a whole. Page 88. This spreading of consciousness is limited within one's own body. The pains and pleasures of one body are unknown to another. Once a godbrother of mine was in the Brahmacharya ashram, and he had a flu, and so he was suffering, so he groaned, and some new person in the ashram who had learned a little bit of Bhagavad Gita said, Prabhu, you know you're not your body. And he leaned over and he said, Prabhu, you're not my body either. The pains and pleasures of the body are unknown to another. Therefore, each and every body is the embodiment of an individual soul, and the symptom of the soul's presence is perceived as individual consciousness. I'm going to read that one more time, because this is a key to spiritual life right here. Therefore, each and every body is the embodiment of an individual soul, and the symptom of the soul's presence is perceived as individual consciousness. There's a lot of... First of all, the body. What is the body anyway? Let's analyze it. The body is made up of senses. And most of the senses are grouped up here. We have openings in the body, what we call senses. What does that mean, senses? senses. So we got senses, and senses, you know, it's almost like sensors. Like we have a lot of machines nowadays that have sensors on it, right? Like Acharya Prabhu gave me a thing called Simple Human. It's a soap dispenser, and all you have to do is put your hand in it, and there's a little light sensor, and then when you put your hand in it, it goes and the soap comes out. I have it by my sink now. Simple Human. I'm more Simple Human now. So you just put the hand in, and this has got a sensor in there, right? So we have senses, and they sense things. So it senses something. So these are little sensors. I've got two sensors here and a couple of sensors here. And really, that's what they are. They're very complicated sensors, machines, to high technology. The body's very high tech. Sensors, 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 sensors. On top of the tongue, I think if you look at it under microscope, you see there's thousands of little sensors. Do you know how many there are? Do you know? Ask our medical practitioners here. How many senses are in the tongue? You know, thousands. And how high tech is it? There's certain parts of the tongue that perceive sweet. Some perceive bitterness, salty. There's different tastes, and they're lined up right on the tongue. It's a sensor, really, if you think about it. Sensor, and the eyes, what a sensor too. It's a complicated system of taking light, reflected light, and it hits a nerve, and that nerve goes down. You know, it's wired. There's a wire connected to the sensor, and that wire goes into the brain. And so the body is made up of senses or sensors in different ways. And then, of course, you got these working senses too. And if you just think about this one day, if you feel depressed for any reason, think about the fact that you have hands, if you do have them, by the way. And it's kind of amazing that we have a couple of hands that can reach out. They can do all kinds of things. I mean, actually, the hand's amazing in what it can turn. I mean, if you try to build one of these things, it'll take you, you know, all the PhDs at Stanford, and they still won't come up with something that works as well as this. And it's living, you know. So anyway, there's all the body is a compilation of these different sensors that we carry around. And shotram chakshu sparshanam cha rasanam grahanam evacha. Krishna describes how, you know, we get that kind of body according to our consciousness in our previous life, and we get it custom made by nature. Nature custom makes a body for us with particular kind of senses. And then he says they're all grouped about the mind. The mind is another kind of sense. It's another sensor, right? Isn't it? It's the ultimate sensor, Satyadeva Prabhu said. He studies the mind very carefully. So the sense, the mind is the ultimate sense. But where are we? Did you ever play this game in school? We used to play this game in school in America called Simon Says. Do you know Simon Says in India? Do you have anything like it? Like Deepak Says? Did you ever play that in India? Okay, let me teach you how to play. Simon Says. Simon's the controller. And whatever Simon says, then you have to do it. And if I say to you, Simon says, touch your head, then you have to do it. Simon says, touch your head. I said Simon says, so you have to touch your head. Touch your head. Now, if I just say, touch your head, and you touch your head, then you're out of the game. Yeah, I have to say Simon says.
We used to have Tota or Mana or...
Oh, that's what it's called?
Tota or so.
Tota?
Tota is better.
Oh, Tota. Okay. All right, so I'm going to play Simon Says, and you when Simon says touch something, then you touch it. And when I just say touch something, but I don't say Simon Says, and you do it, then you're out. You have to stop, okay? Are you ready? Simon says touch your nose. Simon says touch your ear. Simon says touch your left shoulder. Now touch your right shoulder. Everyone who touched your right shoulder, you're out of the game for now. Okay, whoever's going, keep going. Simon says, touch your lips. Simon says, touch your head. Simon says, touch your ear. Touch your cheek. You're out. Simon says, touch your index finger. Simon says, touch your pinky finger. Touch your middle finger. You're out. You're out. Simon says, touch your ring finger. Simon says, touch your wrist. Simon says, touch your right shoulder. Now touch your left arm. Okay, whoever touched your left arm is out. Who's left? How many are still in the game? Raise your hand. Acharya's got this look on his face like, I'm not going to lose this game no matter what. Okay, now, Simon says, point to yourself. Good. So we're all pointing here, right? Point to yourself. So we do this oftentimes in like grammar schools, middle schools, because the kids, they don't want to hear philosophy, but they want to play games. And so we go through this whole routine, and they're all laughing and everything. We come to the very end, and the champion's still left. He's followed the Simon Says all the way through, and then we say, touch yourself. And he's like, he's looking around, where's myself? And then we begin the conversation of what is the Atma, and where is the Atma situated? So the body is made of senses. There's all these places that you can point to, and you can say, my hand, my eye, my ear. But you don't say, I ear, because it's something you possess. It isn't something that you are. But you pervade it, and you're attached to it. But if you lose your ear, you still have a sense of I, even though your ear now is not part of your my. It's gone. So identifying what is actually the self, that's what Bhagavad Gita and our teacher, Srila Prabhupada, is showing us in this sentence. Therefore, each and every body is the embodiment of an individual soul, and the symptom of the soul's presence is perceived as individual consciousness. And that's remarkable in and of itself, because I have a consciousness and I have a particular freedom of will. And if I look out at other kinds of living entities, I can see that they have a similar prerogative. And they also have a body. Cats have a body, and squirrels have bodies, and all kinds of living entities, and they also have consciousness too. And they're also individuals. It's quite remarkable, actually, what a conscious, individual conscious living being is. And that's what Krishna's talking about here. How we're individual, and we're conscious, and we're the one that's experiencing what's coming through the senses. All these sensors, we're the one ultimately is experiencing. And as soon as I, the consciousness, the spirit, leaves the body, then what do I have left? 20 points. What do I have left when I leave the body? What's left? A dead body. Yes? A what? Yeah, well, yourself is somewhere else, but what happens to the body? What's the body then? The sensors no longer work, right? And someone might say, you know, my father died, and you say, he's not dead, he's right there. All the sensors are still there. The instruments are still there, right? The eyes are still there, the ears, the nose, everything. But there's nobody home. Nobody home. It's a what? A douche bag. It's just. Then it starts to deteriorate too, right? How long does it take for a body to deteriorate, Satyadev Prabhu? He's a paramedic.
Well, it starts deteriorating right away. I mean, how long does it take before you smell it?
The body starts deteriorating right away as soon as the soul leaves the body. Yeah?
Well, yeah, it does. The
the brain starts to deteriorate in 6 minutes. The liver starts to deteriorate in about 15 minutes. The muscles start to deteriorate after a couple of hours, and then you start getting into what they call rigor mortis, where the joints freeze up. And then after about, depending on the ambient temperature and the condition of the body, when it died, after, you know, 8 to 12, definitely by 24 hours, you start to, an odor starts to appear. And eventually the rigor goes away.
So that quickly, when the source of the animation for the body leaves the body, then the organs deteriorate.
You know what I was always amazed by? Is that after about 12 to 24 hours, the insects and things, they can smell a dead body way before that. And they, you know, if there's any ants anywhere, they'll get into the house and they'll get on that body. After, by, you know, 24 hours, there'll be ants crawling around and eventually maggots. And actually, the coroner, they can, if they're trying to determine how long a body's been dead, they can determine that by analyzing the maggots on the body. I remember that one. I remember one time I went into, we could smell a dead body. We got called because the neighbors could smell the smell, and all the mail had piled up before the door and everything. And we broke in the door, and way off into the corner of the room, I saw this body there, but I thought it was moving. I didn't have my glasses on. And I thought, wow, something's moving there. And when I got up close, his whole face was covered in maggots, and the maggots were moving. So I thought the body was moving, but it was just the maggots moving. And it was all bloated up, like ready to explode.
So this is, yes.
Same thing in the trees. When the trees died, the bugs and insects and the beetles, they all come and get in there. Even though this tree is dead and standing in there still,
isn't that interesting?
They come and get the things.
I see.
I don't know how do they sense that, but even the, you know, the it's not fall down, it's still standing, it's that tree.
Right.
The beetles get in there.
Interesting. Yes, please.
Actually, me and my dad were just wondering that when a live person drowns in water, and if the person doesn't know how to swim, the person sinks in the water. But as soon as the soul leaves the body starts to float in the water. So is it the like weight of the, I mean, is it because the soul is there, that's why I drown, and now the soul is gone, so the body doesn't have any weight or any vital matter or vitality in it, that's why it floats? Or
let's ask our forensics expert. So you got a mic right on there, too.
I think they have done experiments trying to measure atomically a person before they died and just right after they died, and they can find a difference, but that's not why the bodies float. Initially, after death, the body will sink, and then because of the fermentation in the body of the from the bacteria that are there, they'll create gas, and that will cause the body to float. And that's why they're called floaters.
Now, you know, speaking about the body in these such objective terms is actually part of a culture of understanding. Now, that may sound funny, but in England, they just passed a law that allows people to publicly burn the dead bodies of burn dead bodies. They used to do it in England many years ago. In fact, the famous poet Shelley who died at a very young age, enormously talented poet named Shelley from England. When he died, there's a picture of him on a funeral pyre, you know, on the ocean, on the beach, being burned. And in India, still, you know, when someone dies, they're taken to the burning ghat. And if you've ever been to the burning ghat, it's quite an experience, because then you actually see the body before you, it's being burned. Recently, I just read an article about how this law was just enacted, because partly there are a lot of Indians in England, and they asked to be able to do their own funeral rites, and according to, you know, tradition. And the law was passed, and then someone was revealing that that they used to do it all the time in England. So the author of this blog, who was commenting on this, was saying that it's actually, this is a good thing, because then it allows people to actually see the body when it's being burned. Nowadays, of course, the body's put in a bag and it's taken away, and even when it is burned, it's put in a big, huge furnace. You don't see anything. It just the dial goes up, 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 and then what comes out, basically, later on, you get like a little thing of ashes, which there's some revelation to that when the body's actually burned in front of you. There's a lot more revelation seeing the smoke come out. All this may sound macabre, but it goes to the point that we're not our bodies, actually. And illusory life means to identify with the body and think, I am this body, I am my hand, I am my eye. And there's, what goes into that? Well, apparently a lot, because I spend most of my time feeding the body, taking care of it, and answering the mind's demands. That's a big thing. The mind says, go here, I go there. And I don't even think about it. I just do it all the time. But becoming aware of the fact that I'm actually an Atma, I'm a soul, beyond these mind and senses, that I'm an embodied soul, and I'm in a vehicle. I'm in a city of nine gates, and these are sensors that have been given to me, and they have a specific purpose to take in knowledge. And we're not meant to live to eat, but we eat to live. And in that way, being conscious that I'm an individual soul within the body, this is an impetus for practicing spiritual life, rather than being in a kind of trance. Material life is a kind of sleeping condition, like a trance, where I think I'm my body and I only follow the dictates of my senses without thinking about what I'm doing. I just eat and I sleep and I mate and I defend. And that's what the Vedas say. That's what animals do. They're bound up in that kind of trance all the time. But a human being can come above that trance state into a higher state of consciousness and be aware of the fact that I'm not my body, I'm an Atma. And this acting for the Atma, this is spiritual life. And this is what Krishna is explaining in this section of the Bhagavad Gita. So we're continuing. It gets even more scientific than this. We can know exactly what the soul is and what his symptoms are. So here we are in the top of page 88. Continuing, the soul is described as 1/10,000th part, the upper portion of the hair point in size. The Shvetasvatara Upanishad 5.9 confirms this. Bala gra shatabhagasya shatada kalpitasya cha bhago jiva savigneya sachana tyaya kalpate. When the upper point of a hair is divided into 100 parts, and again, each of such parts is further divided into 100 parts. Each such part is the measurement of the dimension of the spirit soul. Similarly, the same version is stated, Kesha grashatapagasya shatamsha sadrishatmakaha jiva sukshma swarupoyam sankhyatito hi chitkanaha. There are innumerable particles of spiritual atoms which are measured as 1/10,000th of the upper portion of the hair. So this is just from you know, the writings of scripture describing that the soul actually is very tiny. It has some kind of an infinitesimal size. But it's amazing how powerful it is. Even though it's so tiny, it can animate the body of an elephant, or it can actually, you know, like a Lord Brahma, he's an individual tiny soul, but he can have great powers to create a universe. Continuing, therefore, the individual particle of spirit soul is a spiritual atom, smaller than the material atoms, and such atoms are innumerable. This very small spark, spiritual spark, is the basic principle of the material body, and the influence of such a spiritual spark is spread all over the body as the influence of the active principle of some medicine spreads throughout the body. This current of the spirit soul is felt all over the body as consciousness, and that is the proof of the presence of the soul. Any layman can understand that the material body minus consciousness is a dead body, and this consciousness cannot be revived in the body by any means of material administration. Therefore, consciousness is not due to any amount of material combination, but to the spirit soul. In the Mundaka Upanishad 3.19, the measurement of the atomic soul is further explained. Esho nirātma cittasa vidityo yasmin prana panchata samvivesha pranaish chitam sarvam otam prajanam yasmin vashudhe bibhavatyesha atma. The soul is atomic in size and can be perceived by perfect intelligence. This atomic soul is floating in the five kinds of air, prana, apana, vyana, samana, and udana, and is situated in the heart and spreads its influence all over the body of the embodied living entities. When the soul is purified from the contamination of the five kinds of material air, its spiritual influence is exhibited. The Hatha Yoga system is meant for controlling the five kinds of air encircling the pure soul by different kinds of sitting postures, not for any material profit, but for liberation of the minute soul from the entanglement of the material atmosphere. So the constitution of the atomic soul is admitted in all Vedic literatures, and it is also actually felt in the practical experience of any sane man. Only the insane man can think of the atomic soul as an all-pervading Vishnu Tattva. The influence of the atomic soul can be spread all over a particular body. According to the Mundaka Upanishad, this atomic soul is situated in the heart of every living entity, and because the measurements of the atomic soul is beyond the power of appreciation of the material scientists, some of them assert foolishly that there is no soul. The individual atomic soul is definitely there in the heart along with the supersoul, and thus all the energies of bodily movement are emanating from this part of the body. The corpuscles which carry the oxygen from the lungs gather energy from the soul. When the soul passes away from this position, the activity of the blood generating fusion ceases. Medical science accepts the importance of the red corpuscles, but it cannot ascertain that the source of the energy is the soul. You have comments from this medical side?
They know that the energy is being generated in the heart. And sometimes people think that medically uneducated people are thinking that the brain is sending some impulse to the heart, because the heart's like any other muscle, and the impulse from the brain is making the heart pump, right? Just like when you bend your arm, there's an impulse, electrical impulse, that goes to the muscle in your arm that allows that muscle to contract. Without that electrical impulse, the muscle won't move. But the heart is not like that. The heart is generating its own power, its own electricity, but they cannot find it. They can look at it on a graph and they can see the electrical movements, but they cannot see the source and how those cells are generating, because they're muscle cells, they're not nerve cells in the heart. But yet they're generating this energy.
Nice, thank you. I've mentioned this in this class before, that there was a convention of cardiologists at the Moscone Center in San Francisco, I used to work inside the airport at San Francisco Airport, distributing Bhagavad Gita. And we had our own booth, actually. It was quite a miracle. So, and anyway, during this convention, there were cardiologists from all over the world that were coming to Moscone Center, and we were in the international terminal. So they had to pass by our booth, so we met a good percentage of them because they were pervading the airport. And we discussed this with them, and we'd stop them and say, hey, look at this. See, you know, there's something magical about what's going on in the heart. Can you explain it to us? And they said just what Satyadev Prabhu was saying now. They were saying, no, it is mystical. Because they're intelligent scientists, you know, and they're coming to conventions to talk about the heart muscle. You know, that's another thing about just the nature of the body, how high tech it is. I was talking to an architect and a contractor today, and they were talking about building something with cantilevers, and they had these, you know, well, just put the thing back here and then support it. They have all these, you know, those who have studied architecture and construction, they know how to build things so that, you know, they know how to design things and construct them in certain very unique ways. So they're aesthetically pleasing, so they don't take up as much space and things like that. And then you think of the design of the heart. And someone like a cardiologist can spend their whole life studying this one organ, you know, how it works, why it works. And it's so high tech, it has its own mechanism that makes it beat, but they're not even sure what it is. But we're getting information here, why, you know, what the impulse is in the heart. Also dealing with what we call chakras or energy centers in the body. In the yoga system, there's a description of different energy centers throughout the body that go all the way up to the top of the head. And in the heart region, you can just observe general culture and see how people talk about feeling something. And they'll say this all the time. Like, you know, when I offer obeisance, I often say I offer my heartfelt obeisances. I like to say that because that's how I feel when I write it. And then, you know, I'm just thinking, there's a feeling that comes from my heart. Someone might say, you know, I knew it was a good idea, but I felt in my heart that I should really do it the other way. You know? They told me not to do it, but I felt it in my heart, you know, right? There's a feeling you actually get from your heart. You feel from your heart. So there's an energy center here that can't be denied. And what's being described in Shastra here is the souls that right here telling us where we are in this machine of the body. And also we'll hear that the super soul, the supreme, we're an individual part of God, and then God is also right next to us in the heart. And I find just almost universally, every country I've ever been to where I've presented the Bhagavad Gita, if I stick to this one concept when I talk to people, I'll just say, this book shows that happiness comes from within, and I point to the heart. Doesn't matter if you're in Italy or Japan or, you know, any part of Africa, if you say happiness comes from within, you know what I mean? They'll say, yeah, that's what's in this book. It teaches happiness comes from within. Why does it come from within? Because we're actually within the heart, and the super soul's within the heart also. I mean, happiness doesn't come from your hand. How much happiness can you get from your hand? How much misery can you get from your hand? A lot more misery you can get from your hand. Like if you get one little infection on your finger, I remember this in the Brahmacharya Ashram in New York. This one big devotee who was our temple kshatriya. People used to come in the temple all the time and try to disturb things. And they had this code word. There was an intercom throughout the temple. It was a 7-story building. And they'd say, Nisringadev. And he'd come running down the temple. He'd come running down. Who is it? You know, he is a big person. He lifted weights and everything to stay strong for his service. And I remember he got a little infection on his finger. And he was down for about 7 days. He couldn't move. There was so much pain in his hand just from one little infection on his finger. A lot more pain can come from the body than pleasure, actually. But we're situated within the heart, and that's where the energy center is. That's where it's all coming from. Continuing on page 89, medical science, however, does admit that the heart is the seat of all energies of the body. Such atomic particles of the spirit whole are compared to the sunshine molecules. In the sunshine, there are innumerable radiant molecules. Similarly, the fragmental parts of the Supreme Lord are atomic sparks of the rays of the Supreme Lord, called by the name Prabha, or superior energy. So, the experience, one can actually experience that we can experience that we are this superior energy. We can actually feel it for ourselves. Beyond the sensations we feel in the mind and the or in the hand or the legs or throughout the body from the senses, we can actually introspect, and through yoga, we can experience for ourselves our existence as Prabha or superior energy. It's not, you can read it in a book, but until you actually experience for yourself and you feel that I'm not the body, I'm actually Prabha, I'm superior energy. And as Satya Prabhu was saying earlier, there's a happiness just in that. You don't have to be anywhere else. You don't have to get anything else. I was saying the other day in San Diego, I have this experience where, you know, everyone wants to go somewhere else besides where he or she is now, right? And how is that? Like, go to Hawaii. I've experienced you. Go to Hawaii, right? Everyone's like, let's go to Hawaii. You'll be happy in Hawaii because the temperature is nice and, you know, it's a beautiful environment, supposedly. And once you get there, then, I saw a billboard there talking about go to Italy. And if you go to Italy, then you go to Italy and there'll be something like, go to Japan, you know. They'll advertise and you get to Japan and it's like, go to America. And they say, and you're in America, go to Las Vegas. You're in Las Vegas, say, go to Los Angeles. There's always some idea, like, go somewhere else. Wherever I am now, it's not good enough. But in Prava consciousness, that I am the soul, there is no greater gain. That's what Krishna says. When one experiences this for oneself, the experience is there's no other place to go. It doesn't matter where I am. I'm here. I'm here right now, and I'm experiencing that superior consciousness. This is that's who we are, actually. And the mistaken identity that I am this body, which is actually left behind when I leave it, as scrap, as burn it as quickly as you can, right? It's a regulation. Get it out of here, right? You take the most beautiful movie star who's sought after for millions of dollars and everyone has a poster of him or her on the wall. As soon as the soul leaves the body of that movie star, then who cares for it? You want a date? Not anymore. Not anymore, I don't want the date, because the soul's gone. As soon as the soul's out of the body, no more dates. Not interested, sorry, right? The soul's gone. So it's really, that's the pinpoint. That's where the concentration goes in yoga. It goes right to the soul, right to the Atma. And then beyond the Atma, there's the Supreme Atma. And consciousness is where it's at. It's really where it's at. So going within and finding that soul is what Krishna's telling Arjuna, you know, and realize that you have nothing to do with the external body. This whole setup of the battlefield of Kurukshetra, I mean, Krishna's so expert at, you know, the way he's teaching this, and he's putting Arjuna in this situation on the battlefield and then teaching him this knowledge, you know, and it's a sort of a facing his own false ego, because it's not just the body I'm attached to, it's everything else in relationship with the body, right? Actually, I'm defined by what I'm attached to. That's who I am. It's what my attachments are. Just ask me. What do you attach? That's what you sit down and you'll meet somebody at a party, right? And you'll sit down and say, like, what are you attached to? That's really what you're asking. I'm attached to, I went to Stanford University. That's what you're attached to. How am I attached to? That's my alma mater. I give all my money to Stanford University because I'm attached to Stanford University. That's who I am, my attachment to Stanford University. How about your car? Yeah, that's my attachment. That's who I am. And that's how it's advertised, too. That's how advertisers, they catch our attention. They'll put a picture of somebody. It's like, you know, the typical one in America for so many years was Marlboro, the Marlboro man. Do you know who that is? It's a cowboy. There's a cigarette called Marlboro. Just the name of it they thought up, you know, sounds like Marlboro. If I smoke that, I'll be like rugged, you know. It sounds like a rugged thing, Marlboro. And then they show a picture of a cowboy on a horse, and he's kind of got his hat thing down. And for Americans, this is like, it's attractive. And apparently it sells all over the world, too. So people say, yeah, I'll be a cowboy. I'll smoke this thing. And they think, yeah. Or if you go in to buy something, like a coat or something like that, you know, the salesperson will come in and you put on the coat and they go, that's really you. Yeah, that's really you. Those shoes are really you. You know, like, wow, this is really me. You know? But that's not you. That's your attachment. That's what you're attached to. And so I'm attached to my college. I'm attached to my football team. I'm attached to my shoes. I'm attached to my hair. I'm attached to my nails. But I'm not my nails. And I'm not my car either. I'm as much, you know, but because I'm attached to it, that's who I am. But beyond the attachment is the Atma. And the Atma exists eternally. Think about that for a second. Eternal existence. Right now, in time and space, my anxiety is that I have to move on. I have to go somewhere. And also, there's a deep anxiety that I also have to terminate my attachments. My attachments at some point will be taken away, but they'll be terminated. I'll have to give up my attachments. That's like I was saying earlier, travel is kind of a nice experiment because you have to leave your attachments behind. See where you're attached. That's why renunciates, they move around all the time. So you stop for 3 days, and immediately the mind will go, this is mine. That's my corner. That's the corner I sleep in, is a no, move on, keep moving. So we become attached. But the science is not becoming unattached altogether, because that is the nature of the soul, to be attached. But it's where we're attached that's important. Somehow or other, because the soul's tiny, because it's tattvastha, it's become attached to matter. And you know what? It's completely incompatible. I thought about that today. My mother told me a long time ago. She told me, she came up with this theory called the jiggle factor. She said, everything in this world needs to be jiggled in order for it to work, actually. You think of it. You buy a brand new, beautiful car, right? And you think, it'll just work. No, you got to jiggle it. That's why they have body shops and they have, you know, mechanics and stuff like that. It's like, get this thing to work. You know, it's like, okay, I'll jiggle a little here, jiggle a little there. Okay, now it works. Get a computer. Should just work, right? No, you have to jiggle it. In fact, if you buy a computer, even if you get the warranty, if the screen starts flickering and you take it in to the shop, everyone will look at it from a different angle. Someone will say, well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And then they'll say, just do a clean install. Start over again. See if it works. They have to jiggle it. This body, too. You have to jiggle it. But the soul's not used to that because the soul requires no jiggling. You don't have to jiggle it. It just eternally works. But everything else on the outside, you got to jiggle it. And it's a constant anxiety for the soul to have to jiggle everything because it's not used to that. It just works. But if I identify with the outside world, with all the technology of the body, and I think, you know, I am my eyes and I am my ears, and I get concerned with you know, how it's working exactly, and how everything else in my environment is working or not working, more likely, I'm in anxiety completely. So it's a misidentification with that which I am not. And when I become identified as the consciousness, the Atma, the soul, then I feel satisfaction. And then the science of Krishna consciousness comes alive, because then what is my activity as a soul beyond this body? It's a whole new life. It's not a life of a routine that I have to do it in a certain way because my mind says I have to do. I can go the other way. I have complete options. This is life in freedom, the freedom of the soul. The soul does have freedom to act, and it does act, but it doesn't act under the trance of material nature. It acts in spiritual freedom, and it's unlimited. the activities of the soul. And the Supreme Soul, Krishna, performs these activities in complete liberation eternally, never comes under the control of the material nature, and that is called Leela. Leela means he's completely free at all times. So the little individual soul who is attached and entranced by matter can become refocused on Leela. That activity, which is not bound by this material world, never will be bound by this material world. Janma karma cha me divyam. The word divyam, divine. It's beyond the profanation of matter. Krishna's activities, completely pure. So by concentrating there, then we come to the transcendental activities of the soul. And this is spiritual life, actually. So Krishna, in this chapter 2, he goes through step by step and is explaining to Arjuna this preliminary science of the soul and the consciousness. Let's read a couple more verses. Actually, we're not done with the purport. So, whether one follows Vedic knowledge or modern science, one cannot deny the existence of the spirit soul in the body. And the science of the soul is explicitly described in the Bhagavad Gita by the personality of God in himself. So, text 18. We'll read a few more verses from this section. Yes. Please.
So the soul is, no, once it is not a physical thing, how can we say that it's a small or big or medium, or how do we size, you know, consider the size? Because it's Prabhupada several times repeating that, you know, the tiny part of the soul. How do we measure that if it is not?
Well, it's measured here for us. It's saying that it's 1/10,000 size, the tip of a hair. So saying it's like a tiny particle. So the tendency of the mind or the intelligence in analyzing spirit is to take it as an opposite of matter. And matter has form. Therefore, through speculation, I might say that a spirit doesn't have any form. And it doesn't have any specificity. But actually it does. There is a form. Krishna has a form. And has specificity also. And so does the soul. So it's a unit. It's a unit of consciousness. Mamai vamsho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. Krishna says later in the 15th chapter, Anksha, my Anksha. So it's a part of Krishna. Part means that it has some definition. It's an individual unit of serving capacity, of individual consciousness. So, you know, understanding that you know, we are individual and eternally individuals. Krishna points that out to Arjuna very early on, that he says, na tve vaham jatunasam na tvam nemi janadipaha. That he's pointing out that all these individual kings and participants in the Battle of Kurukshetra, they were individuals before, and they'll be individuals after the battle. And even after they leave their body, they'll be individuals. So just take it from Shastra. That overrides the tendency of the mind and the intelligence to try to speculate and figure out, like, form, no form. Just take it, because it's giving actually the accurate information of what the soul is. And you can rest on that. You can actually live in there. And then when you do, just don't worry. Just like Vedas talk about things that are clean and unclean. So they say the bone of an animal is unclean. If you touch it, then you have to take a bath. But then you have a conch shell, and they say conch shell can be used on the altar. We have one on the altar. It's a bone of an animal. So then you might speculate and say, wait a minute, bone of an animal, not, you know, and then your mind will become tangled up, and you'll think, you'll be caught in this speculative process. But if you accept the Vedas as authoritative and that they're axiomatic truths and take it from there, then you can proceed to the experiential part and see for yourself.
The reason why I was asking, because the soul is eternal, it's an eternal thing, mm-hmm. So I was considering it as a big, long, thing.
Long.
And because it is eternal, right?
You mean like a long particle or something like that. Anyway, it's Prabhupada describes in his Easy Journey to Other Planets, when he first started writing about this for a Western audience, he described it as antimatter. And he also, in that, you'll notice in that book, which he wrote when he was in the Radha-Damodara Temple, before he came to America, this Easy Journey to Other Planets, he talked about some scientists who had recently been writing about antimatter. So there's matter and antimatter. So there are particles and, antiparticles. But it's different quality. Yeah, so anyway, your mind is telling you it has to be like this, like that, speculation. Just take it, and then you can experience it for yourself. I mean, you can see that you can follow the progression also in this chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is walking you through what consciousness is, saying it's all pervading within the body. Sort of, you can see it and follow it back. One letter that Satyadeva Prabhu pointed out to me a while back, when Prabhupada wrote to a gentleman he was teaching about the soul in India, he said, you have to introspect within yourself, right? Introspect. Introspect means to look. And intra means inside. So you have to look within and see it. You can see it for yourself. So Krishna's teaching us how to introspect and walking us through the process of experiencing consciousness and the difference between the body and the soul. Even when you block off the blood supply for a while, your hand goes numb. It's the consciousness coming through the blood supply is not there anymore. In any case, just if you take what he says about that, rather than trying to figure out it should be long, should be short, just Shastra gives a kind of description, and then you go, okay, that's it. And then move to the experiential part. Any other question, comment? Yes.
I was also reading a book the other day, it's like an English novel, but in that they say that... So I was reading this book the other day, and there they had this weird experiment where they measured the weight of the person just before death and after he died. So they say that there is a small weight decrease, very, very infinitesimal, but they say that there is a decrease, and they are attributing that to the fact the soul is actually leaving the body, and that the soul has some, since it is, the size is there, it should have some mass, right? So they were attributing it to the soul leaving the body.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier. And, that's experiment. That's trying to measure something. That may be there. We can measure it at any time. I mean, when a soul walks in the room, a couple souls just came in now, and you can feel the impact. I mean, when an individual consciousness, another conscious entity comes in the room, there's an impact. You can feel it. It's palpable, actually, when you're around another living individual entity, the effect that comes from that consciousness. It's amazing, actually. If you think of the subtleties of consciousness, just in communication, there's a lot of talk about this in communication, how people, I've heard it said that, 90% of communication is nonverbal. Like, if you're talking to me and I'm like, you understand the subtlety of it, right? Automatically, it's actually amazing, and you can feel the presence of certain kinds of, conscious living entities, just by their presence. You can measure it, by feeling them, close to you. You can experience their particular kind of consciousness too. Kind of like when somebody eats a lot of garlic and they walk in the room, then you know, and if somebody has a certain disposition or mentality, sometimes, you know, it sort of pervades, you know, if someone's very envious or something like that, then, you know, it's like you can feel it. These things are measurable on a very subtle level coming from the soul, the science of consciousness. Hare Krishna. So this is the Bhagavad Gita. I mean, Krishna is giving us this science of Bhagavad Gita of what the soul is. And then actually becoming awake to the Atma, that I am an Atma. Then I can observe everything going on around me in the body as not me. And it's fascinating, actually, how deeply embedded I am in the process. Sometimes when I'm waking up in the morning, you know, I look at it, I just watched, I watch the whole process of waking up, you know, right, of what's actually taking place, and, you know, how I'm taking up where I left off the night before, and you know, the body goes through its cycles. Actually, I read an article that Mahanidhi Swami sent out a while back about sleep. It was very fascinating. It really, you know, these fancy new washing machines that they have. Well, I guess washing machines have been around for a while. But, you know, but I'm sure they're fancier than they used to be. But, you know, you set a cycle. There's all these cycles you can set, and then it just goes through the cycle. You know, there's a wash, then there's a rinse, then there's a spin, then there's another wash. So, yeah, I know how to wash clothes. And then it goes through that. So Mahanidhi Swami was, sent this article from Ayurveda, which was showing how the body is in sync with the vibrations of the earth and the universe. And at certain times of the day, there are certain distinctive vibrations, and the body goes through cycles. And at certain times of the day and night, certain organs get purified in the body. That's why when you wake up in the morning, you know, you're supposed to use a tongue scraper. Did you know that? You should get a tongue scraper. Because in the morning when you wake up, there's a residue on your tongue that comes from the organs. They're expelling a lot of impurities from the body. So first thing when you wake up, you should use a tongue scraper and take that all off, because it's kind of toxic stuff that's coming out of the body. And that happens when at certain times of the night. So he was showing how, you know, from 10 o'clock till 12 o'clock at night, certain organs are cycling. And then, you know, from midnight until 1 o'clock, then the other ones turn on. And then the other ones turn on. The body just goes through its cycle, and it's synced up to the vibration of the earth and material nature. It's happening automatically. And you can observe it, that you're living in a machine. You're in a living machine. You're animating that living machine, actually. And it's going on like that. So being the observer, as Prabhu says a lot, being the watcher, you know, observe these things. Watch how that's actually happening. Don't be the body, but be in the body and be observant that you are an embodied soul, that you're an Atma within a body. And then, you know, if you know who you are and you know that you're the Atma within the body, of course, you'll maintain the body in such a way that you can stay there, but then the preoccupation of life then becomes toward how to actually nourish the Atma, not the body. And, I mean, it's remarkable because, you know, people, you can, the senses can just become my preoccupation. Like the tongue, we talk about this. We say "sharirad-vidya-jal," Jodendra-yatai called it. The tongue is very voracious. The tongue can keep saying "eat, eat, 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 eat," and I'll just keep doing it until I could actually, if I did an experiment, I could become 500 pounds. I would have no problem. I once ate 84 gulabs. I could probably do it again, but I have more a sense, you know. Than that. But I could do it if I just listened to my tongue all day and I thought that was the goal of life, just to listen to the tongue, or I just did it automatically without thinking in trance when it said to do it. But yoga, huh? Like Father Pierre. So when I become conscious of the Atma, that I'm not the body, then Krishna says, naiva kinchit karomiti yukto manyita tattvavit. He describes how a person who's situated in this consciousness that I am the Atma, I'm not the body, he's aware that the machine, the washing machine's going on, that the senses are cycling, that the light's coming in, but he's not part of that. Naiva kinchit. He realized, I'm not doing anything. Material nature's doing it. It's a profound thing because I'm so used to thinking, I'm doing this, I'm the body, I'm now eating. But I'm not eating. The body is going through that cycle. I'm a soul. I'm different. I'm the Atma. And this is the beginning of spiritual life, to become aware of this fact, to live in the Atma. And then, of course, Krishna's saying that, you know, tolerating the... Then, of course, it's much easier to tolerate what's going on with the body, because you realize I'm not the body. What's happening, the so-called pleasures and pains that come to the body, a person tolerates because he sees they come and go, and they're not actually harming the soul. They're very inconvenient, actually, but, and, you know, can cause some temporary wincing, you know, because I'm connected to the body so inextricably. But there's a consciousness that I'm not that impulse, actually. I read a book once called The Head-Off Stress, written by a Buddhist. And he was talking about ways to tolerate pain, because a lot of people are in chronic pain. And modern medicine, basically, one of the main things they'll do for it is just give you a painkiller. What is a painkiller? Painkiller doesn't actually kill pain. I hate to tell everyone this, but all it does is make you not care that you're in pain. It's true, right? Yeah, so you're in pain, so it's not like you're not in pain anymore. The impulse is still happening, but you're just like, eh, who cares? it's still going on. The experience is still there. The stimulation is still coming. I forgot the point I was going to make from that.
Well, when you realize you're not the body, you may be experiencing pain, just like Srila Prabhupada.
You know, Shrutikirti used to tell me, you know, stories. Prabhupada used to have extreme headaches from high blood pressure. Every now and then there'd be an engagement that he just had to do, and then it was time to do it. It was just, Prabhupada just transcended that and just went out like a young boy and talked and danced and chanted and did everything, and then came back to the room and collapsed. And many, many times, of course, the devotees often witness this near... when Prabhupada was about to leave the body, how even though the body was in so much pain and so weak, Prabhupada just continued to translate as if, you know, the body was no longer there and no longer noticed it. Because his attention wasn't on the body, it was absorbed within the Atma and within Krishna Lila. So, and we know this, you know, you can have a lot of pain in your body, you can have a really bad headache or a real pain somewhere, but if you get distracted into a conversation or your consciousness goes off into another direction, you forget all about that pain until someone reminds you or you remind yourself about it, and then, oh yeah, there's that, and then suddenly attention goes there and you know, it's like the worst pain you've ever had.
That brought me back to my point, which is the book called Head Off Stress. And in it, he was pointing out the same thing that you're saying, is that, you know, if you notice an impulse like pain in your body, rather than thinking, oh, I'm in pain, he said, actually, enter within it, think about what it actually is, and you'll see, objectively, if you separate yourself from it, that I'm in pain, you'll see, oh, it's an impulse. It's a very interesting impulse, and it, you know, it's strong, but after a while, it just becomes an impulse, and it's not... you know, what I'm reacting to as pain. So it's a technique, but it goes to this point of objectifying the body, of what Krishna is telling us here throughout this beginning chapter section of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that you're not your body, you're the Atma within the body. And he tells us to tolerate the different kinds of pleasures and pains that come like winter and summer seasons to the body. There's a lot of emphasis that Krishna gives throughout the Bhagavad Gita to being equipoised. And this one of the symptoms of an advanced spiritualist is being dhira, or undisturbed, you know, by the changes that go on. And that's not possible artificially. But it's not necessary, because you are a soul. And if you become enamored of the actual, you know, happiness or bliss of the soul itself, and are identified in that way, then the externals are just that. They're externals. They really are. So, anything else?
Then what is it that they call life? Is it soul and atma? What is life?
Can you repeat that in the microphone for the record? The court reporter needs to get that down.
No, when a person passes away, his soul leaves the body. He is no longer alive. His life is also gone. So what is the difference between devoid of life and devoid of soul?
No difference. The soul is the source of the life. So as soon as the soul leaves the body, then no more life. Life, soul, same thing. So, you know, that's that. The soul is the life. So as soon as the soul leaves the body, then what you have is you have a dead body. 1 minute living, next minute, dead. The soul stepped out of the body. Ukramantam stitam vapi. Krishna says he steps out. You step out for a while too when you're sleeping. The body's there. It's kind of like you left the car running. You know, it's going on, and you're kind of associated with the body. But not, you know, you're... Yes, Raksha Prabhu.
Could say that life is consciousness.
Yes.
Yeah. Because what is leaving the body at the time of death is consciousness. And a verse in the Bhagavad Gita explains that very nicely. This is the verse that you had cited a while back from chapter 13, the second last verse of that, where it is saying that just like the sun situated in one place is lighting the entire universe, so also the soul which is there in the heart of the living entity is lighting the body through consciousness. As long as it is there, there is life, and at the time of death, the soul leaves, the consciousness leaves with it. So life would be consciousness.
Yeah, life is consciousness, and on a practical level, if you're around people leaving their bodies too, you know, many people are conscious that they're winding it up, they're leaving their body. You know, the process of leaving the body, even, you know, the soul can be aware that they're going through the process of giving up the body. Because that's just what they're doing. They're leaving one body and taking on another body, leaving one situation, going to the next situation. It's compared by Vasudev, who is saving the life of his sister, Devaki, when they're coming home on the chariot after the wedding. And Kamsa stopped the whole thing because he heard a prophecy from the sky. It said, the eighth child's going to kill you from your sister. So he stopped chariot, grabbed Devaki, and he was about to kill her. And Vasudev began speaking to him about all kinds of philosophy to get him to desist. And one of the things he was describing about how the soul is just moving from one body to the next. And he compared it to an inchworm. If you've watched an inchworm, you know, it rears up from one leaf, and as soon as it's like a slinky. You ever heard of a slinky? Did you have a slinky in India? It's this, you know, it's a spring, you know, it can walk downstairs and stuff like that. Like that. It's like the inchworm, it goes in, as soon as it's on one leaf, and it feels situated there, then it comes to the next one, like that, goes over. So you compare it to an inchworm, you know, the body. So people leaving the body, they're actually aware that the body's, you know, One thing my mother said to me when I spent a lot of time with her when she was leaving her body. One thing she said wasn't directly to me, but I was in the room. She said, I think she said it to Nirkula, one of the nurses. She said, "I never wanted to have to do this again." I thought it was profound because, you know, like she was, it was like, I was thinking like what she must be going through, you know, like giving up the body, all, wrapping up all your attachments, whatever it is. But I never want to have to do this again. I mean, who's saying that? You know, it's the Atma who's experiencing this winding up of the body. And also, you know, there's a process. Death is a process of actually the dwindling of the body. And there's sort of a sense oftentimes that you're wrapping up this chapter and moving on to the next. And there's some negotiation that takes place at the end, you know, exactly where it is. And the soul's going through that process, changing from one body to the next. You had a question?
I had a comment, but now it seems totally off the subject. But I read in the beginning stages when one chants, the Maha Mantra is medicine. But in the advanced stages, that the Maha Mantra is food.
So what does that mean to you?
You were talking about, you know, or the body, and then, but we're the Atma, and it needs, I don't know. Then I just thought of that. So,
well, that's a nice analogy. Yeah, I mean, how do you think about food?
Nourishment.
You do? I don't think of it as nourishment. When I'm hungry, I just like, I want something nice. You know? Like, what are you giving me? Is it nice? I don't really think, you know, am I going to be... Well, I do. I do think about good nutrition, things like that. But that's not the first thing on my mind. Otherwise, I'd be eating, you know, different. But, you know, if it's really nice, you just eat it, right? And you're hungry. You have a hunger, and it's like, yeah, nice. Right? Food. You know, you eat. It's associating... There's a lot of happiness around food and eating. Like we were talking last night about this guy, Joe Dominguez. He wrote a book called Your Money or Your Life. And he was part of the frugality movement. He came from Wall Street. And he realized one day or one decade that he was wasting his life. And that money, you know, was like just having money and working for it. Like, what do you get? You get more work. So he thought, like, why do I have to do all this? So he narrowed it all down, and he said, what do I actually like out of life? And he said, I like to break bread with my friends. I like to be with family and friends and eat, you know, around the dinner table and talk and, you know, have a good time. So how often do we get to do that? Not very often, right? We get to do it more because that's part of our culture. It's like, let's eat, you know, we'll all sit together and we'll eat. How about that? That's fun. You know, so everyone likes to hang out. If you just say, we're having prasadam. I remember in New Vrindavan, I was there a few years ago, and someone's house I was visiting, and they were cooking a feast, and there was about 10 of us there, and all of a sudden cars just started pulling up outside. Like, who is that? You know, word got out. You know, we're having a feast, and they just show up. So people like to eat and have food. So in the beginning, medicine, oftentimes medicine, it's a regulated thing. It says on the bottle you have to take it twice a day, and if you don't, you're going to be in trouble, right? So you just do it. So in the beginning, you have to take it like medicine. But in the end, it's like food because, yes, it's nourishing, but it's just you like it. It's part of your life, and you're happy doing it. It's a nice analogy. I wanted to read a letter that I just got about a godbrother of mine. This is relative to the related to the topic of leaving the body and stuff. Because this is our godbrother Grihila Prabhu, who's just leaving his body now. We just got word he has a few days left because he's been struggling with some kind of tumors. And then about 3 weeks ago, we heard that he's going to make a full recovery. And then this just came like 2 days ago. This is a letter from Hari Sari in Mayapur. He says, since the last bulletin on Grihila Prabhu's health, things have changed quite drastically. After a short period of improvement, wherein it seemed some of the tumors in his head, neck, and chest had disappeared, the last few days have again brought adversity. There is no need to go into details here except to say that Grihila Prabhu has now decided that it is time to depart. He is fully ready for it and is no longer either eating or drinking. He has made a peaceful, conscious, and noble decision not to try to extend his bodily existence any further. Since his arrival back in Mayapur, he has undergone a wonderful transformation of consciousness, and all his material anartas have been removed. Last night he was talking with His Holiness Brihat Bhagavat Maharaj, and he informed him that he has never felt more happy than he does now. He feels fully purified and happy. Maharaj told him that he is not leaving for anywhere because he is already in Mayapur. Grihila Prabhu smiled brightly. His purpose is served, and he feels his life is now successful. He has had confirmation from both Srila Prabhupada and Krishna that this is the right decision. Devotees in Mayapur are fully supporting him, and it is expected that within the next few days he will enter into his eternal lila with his spiritual master and Sri Sri Radha Madhava. All devotees are humbly requested to kindly pray for his successful departure and entry into the transcendental eternal abode of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his ever-youthful associates, your humble servant Hari Sari Das. So I just, hearing about the successful departure of a Vaishnav, who, and this happens, we see so often now with devotees who are leaving this world, that I think the book that Indraduna Maharaj had here exactly 2 weeks ago, one of the books was about one of his disciples, I think, who had had a profound departure from her body when she was leaving and had all kinds of crossover experiences, basically, of talking about resonance of the spiritual world and things like that. In any case, we see it over and over again with devotees who have been practicing Krishna consciousness throughout their life, that when it comes to death, that they're aware that I'm not my body, and they make preparations to leave their body in an auspicious way. And when they do, they're more often than not fully conscious and communicating about their, like Grihila Prabhu is saying how happy he is, feeling blissful. Hare Krishna, please, let's give a seat for the devotees who just came in. Hare Krishna, thank you for coming. One more seat on the window there. Here, take a chair. Thank you. So, the investment and the practice that we're doing now, our bhajan, our sadhan, it will be tested at the time of death. There's a Bengali saying like that. And the information that Krishna is giving us here, as we experience for ourselves the Atma, it'll become unlimitedly interesting. It's not that this information in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita becomes dull or dry when I move on to higher topics. Actually, it's the opposite. The more advanced that I become in the practice of spiritual life, and the more I experience that I'm actually not the body, the more these topics in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita about how I'm not the body, I'm actually the Atma, become deeper and deeper and more, and become unlimitedly interesting to us. So the practice that we're doing should bring us to this point. We should measure and see how much I'm becoming aware of my Atma, and how much I'm observing the difference between the body and the self, and how much I'm inspired based on that to take up spiritual life and be involved in spiritual activities. That's when the medicine turns to food, actually. And that's actual liberated life, a liberated life. Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nashochatina Kangshati Samak Sarveshu Bhuteshu Mad Bhaktim Labhate Param. It's not a life of struggle, but it's a life of bliss and liberation and unlimited opportunity. The cage is open. The cage is open. And the prospect of getting out of the cage after being in it for since time immemorial is a wonderful prospect, to say the least. So that's what Krishna is giving us in the Bhagavad Gita. And the practice of Krishna consciousness is perfectly suited for that realization. It's practicable. It's something that can actually be done unbelievably, even from a position of working and having a family and these kinds of things, which are considered in many circles of yoga to be unlimitedly disqualifying. But the process is that powerful. The study of Bhagavad Gita and the actual practice of introspection and chanting the Maha Mantra, the vibration itself, mantra murtram amurtikam, yajite, yajna purusham, sasam yag darshana puman. Narada Muni says the mantra, the vibration of it, it can take us to see the Atma and the difference between the body and the soul, and much further. Much further. It's just that's the preliminary thing. But by that practice itself, we should meditate on it carefully, carefully, carefully. This is the practice every day. Take some time to introspect and see it. If you can see it for 1 second, just for one brief second, experience that Atma, that I'm conscious. And I am conscious. I'm the consciousness within the body. Then, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad, it's like when the sun comes up. As the sun illuminates everything in the daytime, similarly, this knowledge, seeing that I'm not the body, I'm the soul, it illuminates everything by consciousness. So, you know, we have to take the medicine carefully, and then have that experience. And even if you get it for one brief instant, that's enough to enough impetus to change our entire trajectory in life and everything else, and the way we interact with everyone in the world, the way we interact with our own senses, because there's that awareness there now that when the mind moves and when the senses demand, there's an awareness, a growing awareness that I'm not that's not me. Something else. It's moving of its own accord. Three modes of material nature are moving. And it's very difficult to overcome. Daiva hiesha gunamayi mamamaya duratyaya. It's very strong ropes. But the power of the holy name is so great. There's so much mercy in that. It's the speculation process. It can become frustrating, actually. But if I just take the direct line of the what is the mercy of the holy name, we came to this aphorism the other morning, trust the name. Just trust the name. Have trust in the name. Sit down and chant and trust in the name and fully take it in and search for the soul. Sit down, search for the soul, find the Atma, chant as an Atma. And that's really the only experience worth having. That very experience is what the human body is set up for. Nayam deho deha bhajam niloke kashtam kama marahate vidbujamye tapo divyam putrakayena sattvam shud yet yasmad pramasaukyam tanantam. Rishabhadeva says the default mode of following the senses is done by animals. So don't take that as very important. But tapo divyam, practice, this tapasya, it has to be some heat. And then tapo divyam putraka, in that divine austerity of seeing the soul, seeing the Atma, and realizing the potential therein, the purification that takes place rises one to the position of ananda and happiness. And from that position, mad bhaktim labhate param, then real devotional service begins. Krishna says that's the threshold. That's where it begins, from that realization that I'm the Atma. I'm not the body. Do you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Grihila Prabhu has left his body 2 hours ago. So let us take 10 seconds to say individually a special prayer for Grihila Prabhu. for a safe passage to the lotus feet of the Lord. Hare Krishna. Grihila Prabhu Ki Jai. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So now we'll have a artik and then prasadam. And we'll dedicate the artik tonight to Grihila Prabhu, who has dedicated his whole life for practicing Krishna consciousness and now successfully left his body from the holy dham of Sri Mayapur. Gopremanande Aribo. So if we can put all the books away as efficiently and quickly as possible, then we'll have time for artik.